Chapter 2. Philip. There was no one he hated more than James Holden. Holden, the peacemaker, who'd never made peace. Holden, the champion of justice, who'd never sacrificed anything for justice. James Holden, who crewed up with Martians and Belters, with one Belter, and moved through the system as if it made him better than everyone else. Neutral and above the fray, while the inner planets shoved humanity's resources out to the 1,300-odd new planets and left the Belters to die. Who, against all odds, hadn't died with the Chetsimoka. Fred Johnson, the Earther who'd gone native and started speaking for the Belt, was a close second. The butcher of Anderson Station, who'd made his career by slaughtering innocent Belters and continued it by patronizing them all into an arc that led toward their cultural and individual deaths. For that, he deserved hatred and disdain. But Philip's mother hadn't died directly because of Johnson. And so Holden, James Pinche Holden, owned first prize. It was months since Philip had beaten his hands against the inner door of the airlock, while his mother, her mind twisted by too much time and Holden's cult-like presence, had spaced herself and sin along with her. Stupid deaths. Needless. That, he told himself, was why it hurt so much. That she hadn't needed to die. And she'd chosen it anyway. He'd broken his hand trying to get her to stop, but it hadn't helped anything. Naomi Nagata had picked a bad death in the void over a life with her true people. It was proof of how much power Holden had had over her, how deeply she'd been brainwashed, and how weak her mind had been from the start. He didn't tell anyone on the Pella that he still dreamed about it every night. The closed door. The certainty that something precious, something important was on the other side of it. And the sense of vicious loss that he couldn't make the door open. If they knew how much it haunted him, he'd seem weak. And his father didn't have room for men who couldn't do their part. Not even his own son. Philip took his place as a Belter and a man of the Free Navy. Or he found a place on a station and stayed there as a boy. He was nearly 17 now. He'd helped to destroy the oppressors on Earth. His childhood belonged in his past. Palace Station was one of the oldest in the Belt. The first mines had been there, and following them, the first refineries. The newer facilities had followed because this was where the industrial base was, and because it was easier to use the older, unretired crushers and spin separators as overflow capacity. And from habit. Palace had never been spun up. The gravity it had was the natural occurring microgravity of its mass, 2% of Earth's full G. Hardly more than a persistent direction of drift. The station swooped above and below the plane of the ecliptic, like it was trying to elbow its way out of the solar system. Ceres and Vesta were larger and more populous, but the metal for ship plating and reactors, for station decks and shipping containers, for the guns that studded the Free Navy's liberated warships and the rounds that they fired, all came from here. If Ganymede was the breadbasket of the Belt, Pallas was its forge. It only made sense that the Free Navy should pass through there in its constant voyage through the liberated system, and that it should make sure to leave no resources behind. Siahamindake, the harbormaster said, floating in the meeting room's wider end. It was a Belter room. No tables, no chairs, little reference to up or down in its architecture. After so long in a ship built with thrust gravity in mind, Philip thought it felt like home. authentic in a way that the Martian-designed spaces never could be. The harbormaster himself was the same. His body was longer than someone who'd spent their childhood with even low, intermittent gravity. His head was larger, compared to his body, than Phillips or Marco's or Carl's. The harbormaster's left eye was milky and blind, where even the pharmaceutical cocktail that made human life in freefall possible had been insufficient to keep the capillaries from dying. He was the kind of man who would never be able to tolerate living on a planetary surface, even for a short period of time. The most extreme end of the Belter physiological spectrum. He was exactly who the Free Navy had risen up to protect and represent. Which was likely why he seemed so confused and betrayed now. "Is it a problem?" Marco said, shrugging with his hands. The way he said it made emptying the warehouses into the void seem like an everyday thing to ask. Philip hoisted his own eyebrows to echo his father's disbelief. Carl only glowered and kept one fist on his sidearm. "Peres es a Mindanoy," he said. "I know it's everything," Marco said. "That's the point. So long as it's all here, Palace will be a target for the Inners. Put what you have in containers, fire them off, and only we will know their vectors. We'll track where they are and salvage what we need when we need it. It's not just keeping it out of their hands, it's showing that the station warehouses are empty before they even reach for them, yeah?" "Permindan," the harbormaster said, blinking in distress. "You'll be paid for it all," Philip said. "Good Free Navy script." "Good, yeah," the harbormaster said. "Aber..." His blinking redoubled, and he looked away from Marco as if the admiral of the Belter's first real armed force was floating half a meter left of where he was. He licked his lips. "Aber?" Marco prompted, matching his accent. "Spin classifiers vrist neue Ganga, yeah?" "If you need new parts, then buy new parts," Marco said, his voice taking on a dangerous buzz. "Aber," the harbormaster swallowed. "But you used to buy from Earth," Marco said, "and our money doesn't spend there." The harbormaster lifted a fist in acknowledgement. Marco's smile was gentle and open, sympathetic. "No one's money spends there. Not anymore. You buy from the Belt now. Just the Belt." "Belt don't make good parts," the harbormaster whined. "We make the best parts there are," Marco said. "History's moved on, my friend. Try to keep up. And package everything there is for push-out, Sasa?" The harbormaster met Marco's gaze and lifted his fist again in assent. It wasn't as if he had a choice. The advantage of being in command of all the guns was that no matter how nicely you asked for something, it was still an order. Marco pushed off, the thin gravity of Pallas bending the path of his body. He stopped his motion by grabbing handholds at the harbormaster's side and then embraced him. The harbormaster didn't hug him back. He looked like a man holding his breath and hoping something dangerous wouldn't notice him as it passed by. The corridors and passageways leading from the harbormaster's office to the docks were a patchwork of ancient ceramic plating and newer carbon silicate lace. The lace plating, one of the first new materials put into manufacture after the protomolecule's appearance through physical chemistry ahead by a few generations, had an eerie rainbow sheen as they floated past it, like oil on the surface of water. It was supposed to be more resilient than ceramic and titanium, harder and more flexible. No one knew how it would age, though if reports from the other worlds were to be trusted, it would likely outlast the people who'd fashioned it by at least an order of magnitude. Assuming they were making it right. Hard to know. The palace shuttle was waiting when they reached it. Bastien strapped into the pilot's couch. "Bis bien?" he asked as Marco cycled the airlock closed behind them. "As well as could be hoped," Marco said, glancing around the small craft. 6 couches, not counting Bastien's pilot station. Carl was strapping into one, Philip into another. But Marco drifted slowly to the shuttle's floor, his hair settling at his shoulders. He lifted his chin as a question.
Rosenfeld went already, Bastien said. Been on the Pelle for 3 hours.
Has he now? Marco said, and his voice had an edge that maybe only Philip could hear. He slid into his couch and cinched down the straps.
That's good. Let's join up.
Bastien cleared with the dock control system, more from habit than need. Marco was captain of the Pella, admiral of the Free Navy, and his shuttle would take precedence over any other traffic. But Bastien checked anyway, then went through the seals and environment controls again for what was likely the 10th time. For anyone raised in the belt, checking the air and the water and the seals on ships and suits was like breathing. Not something you even thought about, just something that happened. People who didn't live that way tended to leave the gene pool early. They grew a degree heavier as the shuttle launched. Then the gimbals and the couches all hissed at once as Bastien fired the maneuvering thrusters. It wasn't even a quarter G burn, and still they reached the Pella in minutes. They cycled through the lock, the same one Naomi had chosen to die in, then floated out into the familiar air of the Pella. Rosenfeld Goliang was waiting for them. All through Philip's life, from his very first memories, the belt had meant the Outer Planets Alliance, and the OPA had meant the people who mattered most. His people. It was only as he'd grown up and started being allowed to listen when his father spoke with other adults that his understanding of the OPA became deeper, more nuanced, and the word that redefined his people was alliance. Not republic, not unity government, not nation. Alliance. The OPA was a numberless wash of different groups that formed and fell apart and formed again, all of them tacitly agreeing that whatever their disagreements might be, they were united against the oppression of the inner planets. There were a few large standard bearers under the OPA's flag, Tycho Station under Fred Johnson and Ceres Station under Anderson Dawes, each with their militias. The ideological provocateurs of the Voltaire Collective, the openly criminal Golden Bough, the nonviolent near-collaborationists Marutuva Kulu. For each of those, there were dozens, hundreds maybe, of smaller organizations and associations, cabals and mutual interest societies. What brought them together was the constant economic and military oppression of Earth and Mars. The Free Navy was not the OPA, and it was not meant to be. The Free Navy was the strongest of the old order, forged together into a force that didn't need an enemy to define it. It was a promise of a future in which the yoke of the past was not only shrugged off, but broken. That didn't mean it was free from the past. Rosenfeld was a thin man who managed to slouch even on the float. His skin was dark and weirdly pebbled, his eyes sunk deep in their sockets. He had tattoos of the OPA's split circle and the knife-like V of the Voltaire Collective, a bright and ready smile, and a sense of barely contained violence. And he was the reason Philip's father had come to Pallas.
Marco Inaros, Rosenfeld said, spreading his arms. Look what you've done, Koyomis.
Marco launched himself forward into the man's embrace, spinning with him as they held close and slowing when they pulled back. Any distrust Marco held toward Rosenfeld was gone. Or no, not gone, but shifted away for Philip and Carl to feel so that his own pleasure at the reunion could be pure.
You look good, old friend, Marco said.
I don't, Rosenfeld said, but I appreciate the lie.
Do we need to transfer your men over?
Already done, Rosenfeld said, and Philip glanced to Carl, catching the little scowl at the corner of the older man's mouth.
Rosenfeld was a friend, an ally, one of the inner circle of the Free Navy. But he shouldn't have been able to bring his private guard on the ship when Marco wasn't there. The Pella was the flagship of the Free Navy, after all, and temptation was temptation. Marco and Rosenfeld reached out together, slowed their two-body rotation with a handhold jutting off the lockers, and still arm in arm, pushed out to the corridor and into the ship. Philip and Carl followed after.
Going to be a hard burn getting to Ceres in time for the meeting, Marco said.
Your fault. I could have taken my own ship.
You don't have a gunship.
I've lived my whole life in rockhoppers.
Even with only the back of his father's head to see, Philip could hear the smile in Marco's voice.
That was your whole life until now. We've changed the game. Can't have the High Command moving unprotected. Even out here, not everyone's with us. Not yet.
They reached the lift that ran the length of the ship, shifted around it, and swam headfirst through the air, down toward the crew decks. Carl looked behind, toward the operations and flight decks, as if to be sure none of Rosenfeld's guard were at their six.
Why I waited, Rosenfeld said. The good little soldier, me. Too bad about Johnson and Smith making it safe to Luna. Only took down one out of three?
Earth was the one that mattered, Marco said. Ahead of them, Sarta appeared, floating up past them toward Ops. She nodded her greeting as they passed.
Earth was always the prime target.
Well, Secretary General Gao's with her gods now, and I hope she died screaming.
Rosenfeld mimed, spitting to the side after he said it.
But this Avasarala who's taken her place.
A bureaucrat,
Marco said, as they hauled themselves around the corner and into the mess. The tables and benches bolted to the floor, the smell of Martian military food, the colors that had until recently been the banner of the enemy. They all stood in contrast to the men and women in the space.
Belters all, and still Philip could pick out the Free Navy he served with from Rosenfeld's guard.
Self from not self. They could pretend the division wasn't there, but they all knew better.
A dozen people, all told. Like it was the change of shift.
One of the Pella's crew for each of Rosenfeld's. So Carl wasn't the only one to think a little vigilance between friends was a good thing. One of the guards tossed Rosenfeld a bulb. Coffee, tea, whiskey, or water, there was no way to know. Rosenfeld caught it without missing a beat in the conversation.
Seems like a bureaucrat with her hate on. You think you can handle her?
Nothing personal, Koyo, but you've got a blind spot underestimating women.
Marco went still. Even as Philip saw it, his mouth flooded with a coppery taste. Carl grunted softly, and when Philip looked to him, his jaw had slid forward and his hands were fists at his sides. Rosenfeld took a place against a wall, his expression a mask of empathy and apology.
But maybe this isn't the place to say it. Sorry for the sore spot.
Nothing hurt, Marco said. We'll chew it all through on Ceres.
Gathering of the tribes, Rosenfeld said. Looking forward to it. Next phase should be interesting.
Will be, Marco said. Carl can put you and yours in the right cabins. Should plan to keep there. It's going to be a hard burn.
Will do, Admiral.
Marco pulled himself out of the room, floating down toward the machine shop and engineering without so much as meeting Philip's eye. Philip waited for a moment, uncertain whether to follow or stay here, whether he'd been dismissed from duty or was still at his post. Rosenfeld smiled and winked a bumpy eyelid at him before turning to his men. Something had happened there. He could feel it in the air, and in the way Carl held himself.
something important. And from the way his father acted, he had to think it was something to do with him. He put his hand on Carl's wrist. "What is it?"
"Nothing," Carl said, lying badly. "Nothing to worry over."
"Carl?" The older man pressed his lips together, stretched his neck. He didn't look at Philip. "Carl, something I should ask them?" Slowly, Carl shook his head. "He shouldn't ask." Carl licked his lips nervously, shook his head again, sighed, and spoke low and calm.
"Was a report back a while. Observation data from the Chitsumoka. About how the ships with Johnson and Smith didn't die."
"And?"
"And,"
Carl said. The word is dense as lead.
Then he went on, which was how Philip Inaros, in front of Rosenfeld and his half-dozen smirking guards, learned that his mother was still alive, and that everyone on the Pella knew it, but him. Under Byrne, he dreamed. He was standing at the same door as before, even though it would change what it looked like. It was always the same door. He was screaming, beating his hands against it, trying to get in. Before, there had been a sense of fear, the oceanic sorrow of impending loss, the dread. Now, there was only humiliation. Rage lit him like a fire, and he pushed to get through the door into whatever chamber lay beyond it, not to save something precious, but to end it. And, shouting, he woke. The weight of a full G pressed him into the gel. The Pella murmured around him, the vibration of the drive and the hushing of the air recyclers like a voice whispering something just too softly to make out. It was an effort to wipe away the tears. They weren't tears of sorrow. For that, he'd have to be sad. He was only certain. There was someone he hated more than James Holden.